Are we going?
Into podcast.
Potter Who Cast.
But how's it called? Billis Major at your service.
Don't forget me.
Sarah, did you forget me?
Oh, let's go! That's class!
There is no such thing as...
Doctor Who, Series 5, Episodes 4 and 5. The Time of Angels. And Flesh and Stone, with special guest, Nathan.
We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city. Built this city on rock and roll.
Someone else is playing.
No. I don't remember this part. We did the dance here. Someone for the stage. They call us irresponsible. Writers off the page.
I feel like I'm building up to something, but I don't know what it is.
Michael, listen to the radio. Don't you remember? We built this city. We built this city on weeping angels.
Cool, we got there.
I mean, that is the twist of the episode.
Each of them going,
"Who? Hello." Hello, 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 hello. That's when they start laughing. The Time of Angels and Flesh and Stone. The angels have entered the... I don't know what I'm saying. it's confusing. I heard two voices, but there was this bright light, and then I was by myself. I don't know who the other two voices are, because like there's this bright light that's in the it's through the trees, and no one's ever existed here. So who could those two voices
David,
be?
David, it's me.
Who?
Abraham. father of your father, Abraham.
All right. sorry about the whole the killing child thing. But yeah. Who are those two?
Don't worry about it. You're good.
Thanks, Abraham.
I brought somebody with me. Can we redo this entire bit? Thank you. Let's redo this entire bit. I don't like it.
No.
We're gonna walk into the crack and redo this entire opening. Here we go. What opening? There's never been an opening. It's always
it's
just
been an opening. This is immediately after you sang the song.
What's a
yes?
Crack?
Amy, you're being ridiculous. Stop being hysterical. I wouldn't remember if there was an opening before this.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm just gonna go walk over there.
David.
Michelle. I think you should say Nathan.
Oh, Nathan.
Is that what you wanted to do?
That's the intro we're going to do. Okay. Broadcast on the 24th of April, and the 1st of May 2010. May the 1st be with you. Box office. Top of the box office. Oh, yeah, Nathan, this is the new thing we do. So this is two. This is the first time we're doing two parts. So 24th of April is the same as last week, which is How to Train Your Dragon. That was top of the box office.
Sure, sure.
But 1st of May, there's a new contender on top. It's a remake. And it's a remake that everyone has forgotten, that has a really, really, like, crazy cast for a remake like this.
Is it The Heartbreak Kid?
No.
No, that's a few years earlier. Is it The Wolfman?
It's not, but you're thinking similar genre. This one is a horror remake, and it has someone in it who would be in a much better movie the same year, that kind of launched their career a little bit. But they're not, like, they're the main character here, but they're not the main character in the better film that they're in.
What kind of horror movie is it remake?
Yeah,
it's like a slash. It's a slash.
Is it Nightmare on Elm Street?
It is, with Rooney Mara and Jack O'Haley. Rooney Mara would go on to be in Social Network the same year and have a better career than having to be in this movie with Jackie O'Haley. I'm sure is nice, but he could have picked a better movie to be in. Written by Adam Smith, who did The 11th Hour, and written by Stephen Moffat?
Who? I never heard of him.
I don't know, but what he said is that this was, and this is something, Michelle, that you kind of picked up on. He said, this is a quote from him, because this is obviously a sequel to Blink. He says, "The best way to explain the difference between Blink and these two episodes would be to say that I think the best conceived movie sequel ever made was Aliens following Alien. It took the same monster and an entirely different type of film. That is very roughly the model for this. Blink was a small, low-key one. And this is the highly colored, loud action movie one." So this is...
I mean, here's something I'm going to say. I actually think that's wrong, because the thing is, these two episodes are much more like Alien than Aliens. So it is... I get the comparison, because you go, there's more than one.
He's going bigger in some ways. But it's also like this is not an Aliens situation. This is not his Aliens. This is not the Angels' Aliens.
This is not the Angels' Aliens. I think that's the biggest probably the second biggest lie about this episode, is that this is Aliens, when really it's more Alien, if anything. Mm-hmm. It's actually more Alien 3 than anything. And the biggest lie about this two-parter is a lie that's been spread so much that people believe it and repeat it without ever thinking about it. It's the lie that these episodes are bad, and they're not. I believed it. I used to be the Angels two-parter series 5 is so bad. And then I rewatched it, I was like, I am so wrong.
Everyone is wrong about these episodes. Mm-hmm. Everyone is wrong about these episodes.
So wrong. Well, these are so good. I'm willing to say they are almost nearly perfect.
Well, say that for a second, because we got to do the In a Sentence. This is a new thing as well for you, Nathan. This is called In a Sentence. This is a very long sentence. This is like a paragraph. River Song gets the doctor to help her follow a spaceship that ends up crashing into a temple, carrying a weeping angel, which turns to be a temple full of weeping angels, blah, blah, blah. The church, who are now like a military unit, tag along, and their numbers get whittled down as the doctor recognizes the crack from Amy's bedroom has followed them here, and in the end, it serves the angel's doom when they all fall inside of it. And then River leaves with the church as their prisoner again. Yeah, this is the thing. This is a point I want to make for anything. Actually, there's two points. One is that this...
Well, it's feels two like episodes.
It's two episodes, two points. First point, this feels like the template for like a Doctor Who movie rather than just like a two-parter. That's the first point. That can get back to that. The other point is that this is the first time in this like new era that this has felt like an entirely new... different show to like what's come before it. I think the vibe here is so different. The approach is so different.
It's so different. Like I haven't watched I haven't watched Beast Below or Victory of the Daleks in a long, long time. But no, the vibe here is just like so different from the Russell era. Like,
yeah, I would even say that the transformation begins with this episode, and I think we'll say this in the Vincent and the Doctor episode, and this is the moment where it becomes Moffat's show. That episode is going to become. This is the Moffat. Even everything about this is the Moffat, including like the way he handles the like series arc. You know, mm-hmm. I feel like RTD would not have explained the cracks so early. You know,
no, RTD that would have been like 10 minutes to the end of the first part of the 2-part finale.
Yes, and he'd be like, oh, this is the thing you're finally worrying about. But I think it speaks to Moffat's confidence that this early on, he's like, hey, here's the thing where I'm going to talk about this entire series. And later we'll find out this entire season era of the show is about this. And five episodes in? And he's already like, hey, here it is. Yeah. I'm telling you
what it is five episodes by the time we actually get to the reveal of the crack and what it does. And it's so effective. It's so immediately effective.
Mm-hmm. It is very good. The reason this works a lot for me is because both parts feel different tonally and structurally. The first part, it is just ostensibly this. That's why I said, like, this is not Alien, because the first part is so Alien at Alien 3. It is literally like these people going like, I'm going to go over there, see what's wrong, and I'm dead. I'm going to go over there, see what's wrong, and I'm dead. And then the second part is like, the angels are still here, but the scares that they deliver are different. The fear that because they stop being the threat.
The angels kind of aren't the villain of the second part. The villain of the second part is the crack in like a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so effective that it's immediately like the angels are the most dangerous thing. They are like through the crack, they are becoming even more powerful, but they become such a secondary threat. Like they are still a huge threat. They still like are the thing about the episode, but it's just like, no, immediately, like, once the crack shows up, you're like, oh, there is something bigger here. There is something, like, once you even, like, have them ignoring him for the crack, you're like, oh, what the fuck is going on here?
Mm-hmm. I agree. And also, it's startling how, basically, what happens is they were like, we're going to introduce the crack, and the angels are going to kind of take a back seat for a considerable amount of time. There's so many moments where it's like, I'm still looking at the angels. Yeah, they're over there. Anyway, back to the crack. And it feels really smart that when the angels do come back, they are an obstacle, and they are delivering a new kind of scare, which builds up to what I think is the most commented scene of this episode. Which is the scene again, I bought into the lie so much that this was a bad thing. It is not. It is the scariest fucking scene so scary. Entire episode.
It is not only is it the scariest thing in this episode, it might be like top three scariest things in Doctor Who, period.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, yes. It is
such a
terrifying.
Perfect build of tension. Yes. It is such a perfect build of tension because the whole time you're like, We're investigating the crack. What's going on with the crack? Oh my god, the crack is erasing things. Amy needs to get away from the crack. And then we're like, all right, Amy, get away from the crack. You're like, oh fuck, we forgot. There's the weeping angels in the fucking thing. And then the bit where the angels are like surrounding her and she's moving and she's doing it and she's succeeding. And then she trips and you're like, oh fuck, they're gonna blink out the lights. They're gonna be on her immediately. But it's such a genius choice to not have the lights blink out and to instead show us what Amy is not seeing, which I hate to go all like, let's talk about film history. But I think one of the things that most describes tension in the movie or a TV show is this thing that Alfred Hitchcock said, that if there's a dinner scene and then a bomb goes off under the table, that's surprise. But if there's a dinner scene and you see somebody planting that bomb under the table, and the whole time you're going, when is that bomb going to go off? That is tension. So they build up this tension that Amy needs to keep her eyes shut. And then they bring it back at the most, like, at that moment of, like, highest possible, like, stakes, where she needs to get out of the thing or she's going to be erased from existence. And then they throw the angels back in, and in that moment, you finally see them move, and you're like, oh, fuck, they are going to be on her. Shit, shit, shit. And the whole time, you're like, come on, just go, just go, just go. Get up, get up, get up. It is the perfect scene. It is the perfect scene.
Mm-hmm. It is a great scene. I love it. People are wrong. People have been wrong about this for 14 years now.
People are wrong. I think. I get the idea. It is an idea that makes sense if you consider Blink, right? Like, we don't see them move, and that's what makes them scary. But I feel like
Blink kind of brings you into it, where, like, oh, you're looking at the angels, you're part of it. Like, the angels don't move while you're looking at them. It's kind of breaking the fourth wall a bit in Blink,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, and also we've just had an entire episode of the angels snapping people's necks when they look away. They couldn't do the same scare twice. It wouldn't be scary if Amy was walking and they were going like choo choo choo, like, you know, the thing they do when they play that same fucking sound effect whenever they move. They couldn't do that, and I think very smartly they were like, let's see them move, because, like, what is the scariest possible thing you could see them move? Because if you see an angel moving, what does that mean to you? It means you are fucked. Like, they no longer consider you a friend, and they are moving, because that is the one thing they don't do. They don't move when you're looking. And it is a genuine, like, genius choice that I think we gotta respect. Like, we gotta, like, hats off.
It's also so effective because the makeup is just so good. Like, you could just see one of the actors in the Weeping Angel makeup and still kind of be unsettled when they're just moving around, like, as an actor. Like, I've seen behind-the-scenes stuff, and it was, like, midnight, and I immediately turned it off because I was like, I can't do this. This is scary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, it builds up on another thing that I think I used to say was bad, but I'm looking back at it and I'm like, it's good. The idea that an image of an angel becomes an angel
is also another
scary idea. Mm-hmm. But the thing that also, the big idea that I remember thinking is, this is stupid, this ruins the angels, but I think it's really good, is the idea that if you look at them so much through the eyes, then the reflection of the angel in your retina becomes an angel, which is like...
Mm-hmm.
I think the reaction people have to that, and they go like, oh my god, like, I hate, oh, they ruined the angels. The reaction is they add these things, they make them essentially unkillable. But the thing is, they were always unkillable. The thing that destroys them in the first episode isn't like a gun or a thing. It is literally just tricking them into looking at each other.
It's themselves. And, like, if someone even moved one of them, like, oh, immediately it's, you know, it's back. It's gone.
Exactly. And you can't just do that again, which I think is like the very smart choice. And I think you see Moffat's usage of the angels is very interesting, because whenever he brings them back, he always tries to throw a couple more new ideas on top of them. Like, let's see them doing something you've never seen them do before.
Which in some ways is, like, you know, it's the classic Who approach to, like, the recurring monsters. Yeah, like, that's just the thing you do. Like,
how many times have we seen the Daleks be like, we are totally not doing a secret plan. Surprise, we are doing a secret plan. Like, how many times have we seen them do that?
Or, you know, like, 26 years into the show, them revealing, hey, Daleks can fly now, stairs, they're gone. Like,
yeah.
Like,
that was, like, the big thing for that episode. Yeah, they go upstairs, and everyone's like, oh. But this is, if every single monster got treated with the level of, like, actual thought that the Weeping Angels get treated, it is genuinely, like, I think I don't know, it is, like, honestly very impressive. It is also a very, like, ballsy thing to do, to, on one episode, bring back both the angels, that are the fan favorite monsters from series 3, and River Song from a fan favorite episode of season 4. And I'm just thinking about how if this was today, it would take us like an entire season for River Song to say, "I'm going to show up again." Like it's that surf Dracula thing where it would take us a season to see Dracula even get a surfboard. But here in the fourth episode, he's like, "And here's the big two promises that I did in my previous episodes, and I'm paying them off now." And
this is what the finale is. Like he does the, "Hey, this is my finale. This is what it's going to be. This is what it's about."
It also separates his era from the Tennant era so much because it introduces like a completely new approach to the way these episodes work. It really does. When he reveals some people would be like, "I don't know if we should reveal things this early," but by revealing things this early, you kind of, this is an audience that had become expected to the idea that every season there's going to be a thing they mention every once in a while and then it's going to come back in the finale. For this to be so like, "Here's what it is, and here's what's going to happen in the finale," it makes you feel like, "I generally don't know what's going to happen in the finale. Also, I generally don't know what the rest of this Doctor's seasons are going to look like. I can no longer predict what he's going to be doing." And I feel like that's exactly what you need when you're starting a new Doctor. You need it to feel so fresh and such a breath of like, "Hey, it's different now. It's different and we're going to do different things." I hate to be like, this is make a point about the current state of Doctor Who, especially because we are recording this 2 months away before the new series comes out. And it will probably be this episode will probably be out by the time the new episode starts coming out. It's something I think that the Schutte era desperately needs because ever since the 60th, my biggest problem with them, it just feels like series 4.5 to me, with the exception of one thing. And really what we need for Schutte is a Time of the Angels, you know, an episode that makes everyone go like, "Oh, this is different. This is completely different. We are in a new era now."
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that's what's coming with this. I don't know how well that will work with, you know, the shortness of the seasons now, like even more abbreviated at this point.
Yes, there is that problem, you go ahead.
I do think there is enough about like the new episodes that it is like there is something there under the surface that he hasn't been playing the cards yet. Like, you know, like the 60th specials, we'll get to this in like 20 years. The 60th specials are kind of him playing the hits. They're kind of him getting, you know, back into the swing of things. And, you know, like it's bringing in new people. It's bringing in old people. It's just, you know, it's tying things together. And then, you know, Church on Ruby Road is very much for new people. Like it is like we will get to this. We will get to this long, long down the road. But it is for new people. It is purely like, this is what Doctor Who is about. This is who the Doctor is. This is what the Doctor does. This is what the Doctor's deal is.
Right.
Like it takes the entire episode to reveal the TARDIS and what it is. Like that's, or at least, you know, the interior of it. Like we don't see, like the entirety of Ruby Road is kind of from an outsider looking in. Like it is very much after, you know, the Doctor shows up in the cold open, you're kind of like, okay, what's this guy's deal? You know, like what's going on?
Right.
So that's why I think, further down the road, I don't think it's fundamentally who Russell T. Davies is as a writer, but I do think we will have our Time of the Angels moment of, oh, this is what this new era is going to be. This is what the deal is.
The thing is, as well, is that like they've made it clear that it's going to be more influenced by like, you know, fantasy ideas and like, you know, folklore kind of stuff, like goblins and like luck and like all that kind of stuff. So I assume there'll be like a tonal shift as well in places, and like the idea of what will make like a villain will change, and how they approach, you know, superstition will change. I think that will probably like define a lot of stuff, but I do kind of agree in kind of the abstract of like it needs something that's going to, you know, make it clear this is a new beginning, because I'm part of me is kind of going like, I don't know. I think part of me as well is that like we're 2 months out, we need more information, I think, at this point as to like what the makeup of the whole thing's going to be, because we're getting to the point where like, you know,
We have this slow drip. We are kind of at the point where we should kind of at least be knowing like, what are the titles? Who wrote them? You know, like what? Like yes. At this point, we should kind of have the log lines for the episodes. I think in the past we have.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of wonder if they are keeping that quiet because they want to have the surprise of, hey, we got Steve back.
We got Steve back is really good. But I mean, on the topic of promotions, it did make me wonder, was River Song's return anticipated? I know they announced the Wages are back, but did they ever be like, hey, River is back?
She's in the trailers from the time. I don't. Because I'm the person who was kind of plugged into the fandom and, you know, like the marketing at the time. But I don't really remember. I remember that this was like the first non-11th hour episode they filmed. Like it was in that first block. And no, it was the first time we'd ever seen. Like it's when we first saw the costume. It's when we first, you know, all that stuff. Like this is, I think Kingston might have been spotted on set because it was all the beach stuff, but I don't. Yeah, I don't remember quite exactly how hard they were going on there.
I looked back at that trailer that I think that is the first trailer they put out for Series 5, which is the one where it's Eleven and Amy in the grassy hill and they're talking. And
yes, that's the teaser. That one.
Yeah, that one has no River Song. I will also tell you, interesting, that that video, which is the first one, came out February 20th, 2010. The first episode premiered April 3rd. So it's not the first time Doctor Who took its sweet ass time introducing shit.
I mean, no, yeah, this very, very much like, very much a lot of that, yeah. But yeah,
Can I say as well? Like immediately off the bat, their chemistry is crazy. How in sync Smith and Kingston are. It's just off the bat.
Especially because you know. Yeah, because you've got Tennant and Kingston and the Library two-parter and like it's great there, but you're like, okay, it's a new guy, you know, he's a young, like, who knows what Smith can do? And no, it's immediately off the bat like, oh, this makes sense, and it's why it makes sense that Moffat does make the decision of like 90% of River Song stuff will be with Smith, like.
Well, but I will say, looking at this episode, it is astonishing how sexless him and River are. And this was a thing that when this was in the air, I remember watching this and being like, I just don't buy them as like these like star-crossed lovers and they're going to keep coming back to each other. I just don't buy these two. But now with the benefit of time and knowing that that Capaldi's around the corner, all of those jokes about, yeah, maybe when you're older, or maybe when you're like, oh, you're too young right now, all those jokes actually make sense, because it's funny, Smith and Kingston shared 10 episodes. I never felt the shred of chemistry, sexual chemistry between them. Capaldi and Kingston shared one episode, and I'm like, these two are fucking every single day. Like, these two cannot get their hands off each other. And I know it's not intentional. I know he was not like saying, well, the doctor that she remembers is the one that's her husband is the one after this one, you know?
Which, yeah, it doesn't work because it is like she doesn't meet him until she's about to die. Like that's kind of the crazy thing about that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go like, yeah, but the Knights of the Realm last like a 100 years as a way to be like, yeah
but they're staying there. It's not like other than the library we ever met a River Song who knew 12.
Right. Which is, I mean, it would have been so, like, such a amazing, like, called shot for her to be like, for River Song to be like, are you Peter Capaldi? Straight up, go, are you the guy from the thick of it right now?
are you the guy from the Pompeii episode?
Yeah. Are you that lady from Broadchurch right now? No. Are you the guy from Sex Education? No, not yet. It would be amazing if he just called every single
show. Are you tenant again? Which tenant are we?
Yeah. It would be really funny. If I had that power, I would get Alex Kingston in the booth, just record a line secretly add it into Forrest of the Dad, where she goes like, which 10 are you? Like, which of the two 10s are you?
Wait, how old are you and Donna? Like, where are we here?
Yeah. Although apparently, yeah. I can't stop thinking about the fact that canonically the 15th Doctor only lived for what, 16 hours? Literally, there were no other... that is like, what a day, right? You wake up as a blonde woman, you go to sleep a black man. That is a huge day for you right there. It's just a huge day. Like, 6 hours ago I was a white woman, 6 hours from now I'll be a black man. It's just an absolute, having the week from hell, my guy.
I mean, yes, he regenerates, he bi-generates, but he still exists for at least another, like, 50 years.
That doesn't count for me. 50 hours, that is all I will give him. Also, I feel like if at any point they have another adventure with the 15th Doctor after the Giggle, doesn't that ruin the point of what the Giggle is about? Isn't he supposed to not be doing this?
I don't think he'll adventure. I think he might, like... In like 20 years for the 80th anniversary, like, they'll bring, like, Tennant back, and he'll be, like, hanging out at UNIT. He'll just, you know, he'll...
I do think it's a funny image to, like, have an episode where it's like, Earth is being attacked by the pom-poms, and they're going to destroy Earth. I got here too, like, the shooter's like, I got here too late. Isn't there anyone who could have helped her earlier? And then just got to Tennant reading a newspaper, like...
eating ice cream on the couch, watching like I'm a Celebrity or something.
Yeah,
he's watching Pointless, and he's just getting really mad.
Sorry, I'm retired. I'm sorry. I can't. I'm sorry.
Doctor, the Daleks are threatening to detonate reality again. And he's like, I don't really care. Like, I'm, you know, I've got an Among Us game to play with, you know, Rose.
I'm retired. Have you tried calling the other me's? Have you tried calling me the me with the blonde hair and the big coat? I think you'll answer. I'm too busy right now.
Yeah, I got stuff to do. I can't save the world right now. I'm retired.
What episode is about Time of Angels? Right. So
yeah.
Which, I mean, not like there's not a ton to talk about with this. There is so much to talk about with this.
Mm-hmm. The church.
We here at Potter Whocast love our tangents talking about the show's future, because it is the most fun show to speculate about the future. Like, what does speculating about the future of Marvel looks like? I wonder which popular actor they're going to cast as the Fantastic Four. Like, is that it? Like, a cat should call me when Marvel speculation is like, I wonder what forked timeline we're going to be dealing with this season. Like, that is the shit we're dealing with, guys.
Yeah, it's also like, I always kind of end up on the podcast at, you know, like, major, like, change points for Doctor Who at this point. Like, this is kind of what I do. Like, it's always kind of going to be a state of the show episode whenever I'm on, I think.
Yeah, anyway, bring back the Harmony Shoal. Moving on.
The party's over, Dr. Song.
Yet still you're on board.
Sorry, Alistair.
I needed to see what was in your vault. Do you all know what's down there? Any of you? Because I'll tell you something. This ship won't reach its destination.
Wait till she runs Don't make it look like an execution.
I'd also like at some point to talk about the cold opening, because it's the cold opening is
The cold open is it's crazy,
really good. It is also, I was going to talk about the cold open. That is why I asked if she was introduced as being back, because if you did not know she was coming back, that cold open is like, all right, Weeping Angels episode. River Song. It's that meme of the girls being like, oh, we don't care about Justin Bieber. Character actor James Urbaniak. Like, it's kind of like.
Well, I mean,
first
of all, you'd be like, oh, wow, it's the lead singer of hip band The Streets, because that's the guy from The Streets. I'm the only one who knows the band. And then you'd be like, oh, wow, it's an old guy in a tuxedo. And then you'd be like, oh, wow, it's River Song. And you'd be like, oh, wow. And then you'd be like, oh, wow, it's a little church. Oh, wow, it's a box. Oh, wow, it's a box in a box.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, oh, wow, it's all this stuff. It's a really good, like, that's where the whole thing, like, you know.
I mean, the cold open plays it as a surprise, but it's also like, I know how this show has always functioned with surprises, where it's just like, it is playing to the person who is just like, doesn't pay attention to, like, even the next time on.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The thing.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was gonna say the cool open is like going back to the idea of this being like a kind of a template for a movie. That feels like a very kind of like, you know, no, I don't want to say feature film, a very like operatic opening for like a two part. Like, especially with, like, you know, usually with the two part openings, it's very, you know, kind of, it's like any kind of cold open. You know, it's just like one little scene, like Rise of the Cybermen's opening scene being like, you know, Luke being like, it's the future. Whereas like this is like cross cutting, it's like going all over the place.
Yeah, it is immediately like just throwing you into it. Like you get the like, oh, this guy's, you know, this guy's hanging out with some peacocks. Oh he got kissed. Oh, something's up. Mm-hmm. Oh, like is that Alex Kingston? And then like then it cuts to the church where it's just like, oh, you know, here's Amy and the doctor having a fun little like adventure. They're doing bits. Like, this is how he keeps score. He like, I love Smith running around the museum. He's, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's a good, because the first two episodes before this, it's not like a good showcase of him just being like having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like Beast Below, you know, he's still kind of thrown into it. You get that like righteous anger that comes to like, you know, become a huge part of him. And in Victory of the Daleks, you know, he's facing off against Daleks. But this just him kind of running around, like it is that thing that Smith has fun with, of just like he's just hanging out, he's just being a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Which I also want to say, I am someone who at the time, you know, when I'm 17 years old, you know, ages of 17 to like 20, I loved Matt Smith. He was my doctor. And over the years, I've kind of been like, he was all right. You know, he's kind of the worst actor of the modern bunch. Just like, he is so good in this two-parter. He is really incredible.
Yes, yes, yes. You said he was the worst doctor. I was like, this is the one that made me go like, oh, right, I remember why everyone fell in love with this guy. Because the bit where he's in the control panel and he's like, do you have any better ideas? It's like such a good, like, I remember going,
the stuff in the forest with Amy where he, like, he's trying to get her to close her eyes and the countdown's going on. And like, he is so good there. He is just like, especially because I've been watching House of the Dragon recently, and it's such a different performance. It's such a better performance. I think it's the best stuff Matt Smith has done in his entire career. But it's just like, I come back to this and I'm like, oh, right. No, he's really good at this sometimes. Like, he is, when he's on, he is just like up there.
The thing is, I know there's this bit in this episode. It almost feels like there's two bits in this episode where Matt Smith's performance for the rest of his time could have gone to. There's the bit at the control panel where you really see that this is like a 900-year-old man pretending to be like full of childlike and wonder. And then the mask drops for like a moment and you go like, what? I'm doing the best. What do you want me to do? That is really good. But there's also the bit where they're realizing that the statues all have one head. And for some reason, I Am the Doctor is playing. And that is where I think his performance goes for the rest of his era, where it's always like, ah, I'm so cool and I'm always on top. And that fucking song playing that bit, it's like, this is supposed to be scared. This is supposed to be, we're supposed to be scary. This is supposed to be like tension, but we're going like, and it's like, guys, like, there's like this, I just really don't like that song because I feel like even in, we're like four episodes in and I'm already like, done with that particular track. It never really felt like that a track got so overused in the Davies era, but maybe I'm wrong. But that particular track is just, that is what I think his performance in his era becomes, just the whole like, as opposed to more, you know, constrained.
I think Murray Gold even kind of realizes that, because you get to the Capaldi era and Capaldi's theme, which is great. It's just so much more low key, and you almost like can never quite clock when it's actually playing during an episode. Like, it's just kind of it. I think he realizes that, and he just kind of immediately pulls back the lever and just it's so, you know, it's. Which, you know, why I think Shooty's theme is so interesting, because it is kind of like a return to like the Smith, like bombast and like, you know, just like playing it like big mo.
Yeah, the bombast. I would be lying if I told you that the bit at the end where it's like, the one thing you don't put on a trap is me. I would be alive. That bit didn't worry. Like, that bit worked. Of course it worked. It's just that this episode makes a request out of Smith, which is, we need you to convey just how out of his depth and completely terrifying this moment is for the Doctor, for even the Doctor. And he matches that perfectly. Like, he reaches that and he goes past, above and beyond. And that's why that scene, he's also another reason why that scene with the angels moving works so much, because that scene is, you know, Amy is alone. But also you convey through the way that that Eleven is talking to her through that thing, just how fucked she is. Like, you gotta get out of here. If you do not move, you will be erased from existence. Which is like, imagine telling an actor, being like, all right, I need you to convey to this other person who is not on the scene with you. She's not even in the same set. I need you to convey to her that if she does not start moving, the statues won't kill her, but she will be erased from existence. Imagine telling that to a person and then expecting them to go, all right, I will deliver work now. Like, it is such an insane request. And the fact that he matches it and you feel it and you get it is like an astounding,
the moment where he's
working his ass off here.
The moment where he kind of just puts like the communicator on his forehead to talk, because he's just so frustrated and defeated. It's so well played. It's such a good moment of vulnerability with him, which I think it's something we don't ever saw quite the same from Smith. I might be wrong, but it's a moment of, it's a kind of vulnerability we never really saw from Smith the rest of his era. Like, it is, it's an almost defeat. Like, it's when you're talking to a friend and they're not listening to you and you're just like, I don't know what to do. I can't do this. I'm out. Like, it's such a good.
It also is a continuation of Tennant's, you know, whole vibe where he's always like at the top of the game, and the instant something starts bringing him down, he's like, uh-oh, activate emergency mode. Like, I gotta like get the fuck out of here. It is like a continuation of that particular strand of the modern Doctor per se, which is again is just a sign of how well this episode works and how well this episode establishes itself in a statement, as a statement of intent, you know, more than the 11th hour, I think, more than the 11th hour could ever be. This is a true statement of intent. The 11th hour, I think, is the showy version of, like, it's when like they make a whole dance, a dog and pony show about, okay, this is what we're about, this episode you are reading the policies of the series. They're giving you the actual policies that in the list of in the paper, you know?
Yeah, no, like especially because Eleventh Hour is it's a post regeneration episode. Like you're never gonna really get the vibe from that. Like you're gonna get like, okay, here's an idea. Here's a whiff of it. And I think, you know, not to go back to what's going on right now. I think even kind of Ruby Road is still kind of that with Shooty of like, okay, I get a whiff of what you're trying to play at. I don't know what you're you know. No, this is 100% like this is the star making moment. This is like you've left the tutorial area and you've seen like this is that moment in Breath of the Wild where you like walk onto the cliff and it just, you know, plays the theme and it plays right. The title. That's what this is. This is just like, oh, okay. This is what I've gotten myself into. This is what this is. Okay, I get it now.
Can I say as well, that one scene, which is really weird because he's got a jacket back on and took his jacket off. I wonder who got fired for that blunder of continuity. It was really accidental. That the way he delivers that scene is also so beautiful. The way he's like,
it is one of those moments where I was like, oh, Smith is incredible right here. Like he is, he's so good. Also, a thing I noticed and had to like slightly like replay is him losing the jacket. Like it is you see the angel's hand like grab onto his jacket very briefly. It's very interesting. Like it's a blink and you'll miss it, but it is there, like the hand closing. Which
is very weirdly shot, yes.
But it's also kind of maybe priming you for like, you might see the move again.
The reason why I say it's weirdly shot is because you never see him slipping out of the coat. It cuts to a shot of the Weeping Angels and then a shot of him already running away.
Yeah.
So, and you never let him talk.
It also kind of cuts away from that for a second. So I feel like the idea is like, oh, they got him. And it's like, nope.
Yeah.
It's probably also just very awkward. Like as someone who wears jackets a lot, it is very awkward to get out of a jacket like that you're not actively like that has something else going on with it. Like especially when it's going to be like a rigid body like an angel behind you. Like I think that's just cut because it's like there's no way to make that look good. There's no way to make that look cinematic.
Right.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known you better.
I think, sir, you know me at my best.
Something else, another performance that I thought was brilliant, and a moment that makes me feel like it's a very kind of vulnerable moment, is the way like Smith plays Ian Glen's death scene. Ian Glen, I think, is incredible in
this episode. Ian Glen is
really good.
But the death scene where, like, you know, he's only known this guy for like 3 hours, and like you can see how heartbroken he is. He's like, you know, I gotta die now because there's no way I'm getting out of this situation. You gotta run. Like the way that scene plays out, he's like, you know, I think you knew me at my best. The whole thing is just like such an incredible moment. I think it's such an incredible. It's such like a real state of intent to be like, in my universe, the church became an army after like a couple of years because they just felt like they could, you know, take up arms. It's such a like really, really interesting to the world building that I think kind of like we kind of clown on a little bit because, you know, it goes to such like extreme lengths as it goes on, but like it's such an interesting idea to pose this thing of like, you know, the church returns to like a military state after however many years and they start taking prisoners and they start like, you know, escorting prisoners to places. That's such a really weird kind of push. Can I talk about one of my problems with this, and it comes back to what we've talked about, is that I think like the ultimate resolution is One, the shot of all the .png files of angels. This looks really, 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 really cheap.
Not .png. The shot of the Blender files of the angels going I did think that shot was silly as F.
But the resolution I think is just a bit too rushed. It's a bit too quick. It's a bit too like, you know, oh, what if I tip the thing over? And they can, I guess it kind of ties into like, you know, the anti-grav thing, but like it feels a bit kind of, you know.
Yeah, oh, it is like you spend so much of the rest of the episode on like the tension of like the angels not being there and like the drama of like what's going to happen with Amy, what's River's deal, all this stuff. Like the middle part of this episode is just kind of like a character drama. Like it is just character beats. It's mystery. Mm-hmm. But then you bring it back and you're like, "Oh, I have 10 minutes left. I need to finish this somehow." I guess we just tip them into a, you know, just we just tip them into a hole. Like, I also want to say though that the very funny thing about the cold open, I meant to come back. This is the thing I took about the note. The actual end of the cold open is incredibly underwhelming. Where it's just like, you know, it's got all this, and then she's like, follow that ship, follow that cab.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's straight into the theme, and it's just like not the best cold open. Like, you know, well, it's a great cold open being that, and then it just kind of dips down. It's like almost there.
Yeah. I also think it's funny about the cold open. Something I really liked is that this is the Headless Monk archive, and when the cops show up to chase them out, it's just two guys in like cop uniforms.
It's just two security guards. Like they're yes. You know.
Mm-hmm. Budget cuts at the Headless Monk archive.
It's really fun. It really is funny for me personally because it is literally just like
when you're Headless Monk, you have to do like a 3-year internship as just like, you know, a security guard, like. You know, you've got to sit at the front
before
desk.
Before they cut you off your head, yeah. Before they cut you off your head, you gotta spend a couple of years with the head.
Yeah, you gotta get hazed. Like, you know, they're gonna. Oh! Am I gonna cut your head off today? No.
Now you get to keep your head for a little bit more, buddy. What else do I want to say about this episode? Okay, so let's do a little bit of a home media corner because me and David have a very specific complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
I bought the much talked about New Who complete Blu-ray set. God bless you, BBC. I bought that one, which, by the way, for starters, just want to say the way the discs are put in the box, fucking hate them because they're doing that thing where, you know, if I want to watch the Christmas Carol episode, I have to take off the Series 5 first batch episodes disc and the Series 5 second batch episodes disc and then the Series 5 last batch episodes disc, and then I can get the fucking Christmas Carol episode because it's all the way in the back. Anyway, I hate that. But the reason why me and David have a very similar complaint is because they split the two-parter between discs, which is so annoying.
The thing is, I believe this is how it was. I was someone who, like, yeah, I'm 17, 18 years old, and the DVD's coming out, and it American DVDs so expensive back then. But you know, I saved up my money and I bought it for $100. Like, so I had the original DVD release of it, and I believe that's how the episodes are like split up on the DVD release. I believe the first disc is just 11th Hour, Beast Below, and then I believe that's how it is.
The first disc is
it's 11th Hour and Beast, and then because the second disc, the picture in the second disc is Churchill doing the fucking Viva Victory, and it's just like and the episodes are Victory of the Daleks and Time of Angels, and then it's I believe that the rest of them are 3 episodes each. But like,
I believe that's how it is on the original DVD release. It's insane that they did not change it for the Blu-ray, like for the Blu-ray release period, or that the Blu-ray release like 14 years down the road. Like, that's insane behavior. That's deranged.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's really interesting how the much talked about New Who Blu-ray set is just a repackage, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
We take whatever scraps we can get. That's it.
I have some stuff to say. Can I find what they were? Let's see. We get a Cyber Cane reference. Shout out to Cyber Cane.
Cyber Cane reference. What a king.
Mm-hmm. The Cyber Cane fell and no one heard it because it got zapped up with the crack.
That's the thing he remembers. I like that, right? It's the Daleks, the Cyber King, and then ducks in the pond.
I mean, wouldn't you remember the Cyber King? Like the Cyber King was like, it was a couple weeks ago for him, depending on like how long this whole Time Lord Victorious thing. When I was like, it wasn't that long ago. Like, he was like, there was a, there
don't
was a
you,
giant,
don't you remember?
Like, There was a giant Cyberman Gundam wandering around Victorian London. Like, that's something that would stick with you, I think.
Right. Amy, you don't remember the Absorbolov? You do?
You don't remember the Absorbolov and his iconic chicken?
You shouldn't remember that.
That is the
one thing that you do remember.
You don't remember the time that the Prime Minister killed the President?
Oh, my God. And they didn't erase that. I remember that. Don't you remember the time Obama became the master? I remember that.
Maybe one of the all-time funniest moments in Doctor Who.
Can I just say, the episode of SNL that would have happened after that happened would have been incredible. It would have been the jokes they would have made in the cold open of like, you know, everyone changing and then, you know, weakened up the hands, like, I don't know, it's a Tina Fey at the time, we were like, you know,
it's Tina Fey at that point.
Everyone turned into this, but you know, didn't change anything. It was some stupid thing. I don't know. Michelle, remember, okay? Don't forget. Remember. Just remember.
All right.
Just don't forget. Just remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Remember what, David?
Hey,
David, David, for a second you were just wearing a different t-shirt. What was up with that?
No, what are you talking about?
Anyway,
you were wearing a t-shirt that said, like, Gamer Era Season 2?
No, no, I mean.
There are two things we got to talk about before we wrap things up, because we have been talking about this episode for an hour. Holy shit. It's amazing
quite,
what happens
not quite
when
an
you
hour.
Well,
close.
Yeah. It's amazing what happens when you like and when episodes are good, right? K9 anyway.
Haven't even gotten to like half the stuff that I like about this episode. Like there is so much I can
David,
talk about.
We should take that video of the angels falling into the crack and just put a PNG of K9 going.
No, it's Stark Reality and the blonde kid.
Yes, it's just falling into the crack.
The professor, and they're falling into the crack, and you overlay people going like, "Yay!" and like applause as they fall in.
It's not even the transparent PNGs, just the ones you can pull off of Google Images with
backgrounds. It's that scene from The Giggle, but a shooty going Stark Reality dies. You know that? I love that, man.
Gotta talk about that scene, because the BBC, the Doctor Who social media channel, like, uploaded one of those video, like, a video of that, like, scene. And it's like, you know, like, oh, the Cyberman and Adric, and it's clips of all these, and it's then Mavic Chen, and there's
no,
just
you're
nothing.
Kidding.
There's just, yeah. Like, it's just, you are like, kidding, like it's doing, like, Sarah Jane died, and there's a clip of Elizabeth Slade, and then, you know, it's like all of this, and it's Mavic Chen, and there's nothing.
Sarah Jane Smith.
it truly does underline how insane it is that they reference Mavic Chen.
Is that the most club shitto moment in Doctor Who history?
It's one of them.
I think it is.
It's up there. It's top five at least. Like top three, top five.
Yeah. There's Macra in Gridlock, which is a
no.
That is because that's literally him being like, because he literally said like that was me being like, you know, can I throw something that people would, like, only tired people would recognize, and everyone else would be like, oh, I don't know what that is. And he was like, yeah, Macra, which is
there's other stuff, though, where it's just like, you know, like Smith or Capaldi is just listing off guys. Like, it's just naming some guy's Doctor Who edition. Like, so, like, yeah, you could.
It's Mark Maron going, who are you guys? Mavic Chan?
Who are you?
Who else?
Mavic Chan. They were Richard Jane Nixon, Mavic Chan.
Sarah Jane Smith. She died.
Richard Nixon. He died and we didn't care.
I love that, man.
Odd Bob the Clown. He died.
I love that, man. We just gotta edit as many of insane polls into that thing and just have them like have Tenen be like, I love that man, I love that woman, I love that clown apparition that it was occasionally Southern.
K9, he's stuck in Australia with stark reality. I love that dog.
Yeah.
I love that politician Nick Briggs played on Torchwood. He said
we should kill.
He died.
Danny Llewellyn.
Yeah. Harriet Jones. I love that tired woman. I thought she'd look tired.
Dalek Sek. I love that guy's spats.
Anyway, the two things I wanted to talk about before we wrap it up is one of them is the way that they hint at next series' arc is really good. It's very subtle. It is also very obvious that who the person that she killed. It is very, very obvious.
I mean, even from the first time that they like hint at it, like at the start of Time of Angels, it's like, oh, so she killed him, right? Like that's what happened. Like it's that moment where Amy's like, oh, are you two married? And it's like, she killed you in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, what else? So there's that, and there's also the true goat, Angel Bob.
Angel Bob. What a guy. You gotta love Angel Bob.
They call him the Sacred Bob, don't they, at one point?
That's before he becomes Angel Bob. Like, it's...
Sacred Bob, Scared Bob.
Because in England, like, oh, yeah. Bob's a sacred name. And he's like, Smith is like, Sacred Bob, Scared Bob. And then, yeah, like...
Sacred Bob, Scared Bob, skippity beep, boop, 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 boop.
The bit where Angel Bob is like... They say, I'm like, why are you doing the same? He's like, well, it's really just because we want to fuck around with you guys. It's not really anything like major. We're just doing some bits. Yeah, we just want to mess you up. And they all laugh, and they're like, I think that's them laughing now, sir. It's like, fuck, it's just a great moment.
Yeah, but that is an underrated part of this episode, that the angels do bits. I love when a writer makes a villain just kind of do bits.
Mm-hmm. Well, but also it is very telling that they give the angels a voice, and at no point do you feel like it is diminishing their threat or their scare factor, because it's the voice of somebody we had a little bit of like a fucking like connection to him, but it is the voice of somebody we know. And it is also very much, they are very clearly like, this is the voice, they're using my voice to talk to you, but I'm dead.
Well, it's not even they're using his voice. It's like they're literally using his brain. Like, it's not even like the angel being like, hello, doctor, I'm going to get to you. It's just like, hey, so they want me to let you know that they're going to come kill you. Like, hey, I'm sorry, I'm just, don't shoot the messenger. Like, that's kind of the vibe of it. It's like, they're not talking directly. They're just like using this guy's like brain patterns to like, what would this guy say in this situation? Like, it's kind of like the gun to the head thing of like, hey, I've like, you know, you've got the bad guy in your ear, and like, they've got this bomb vest on me. I am sorry. Like, not my fault. Like that's I think what makes it good and effective. Like it's not like the angel like kind of mustache twirling. It's just like, it's the angel using, like, it's the angel just using a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also, it is a an extension of, how do I put this? It is like a continuation of the, hey, who turned off the lights bit from Planet of the Forest of the Dead. But it is an extension of that bit in the way that he's playing with the same tunes. But it is, again, it is a thing that they use to kind of like highlight just how terrifying the angels can be. Because, and again, like, that's the thing that really works for me about this episode. It does not rest on its laurels. It keeps elevating the stakes and keeps elevating. It doesn't give you a moment to stop. That is the part that I think is most like Aliens, in the way that it's like, all right, there's one angel, and then the image of an angel becomes an angel. And also, Amy has an angel on the eye. And also, there's more than one angel in the thing. Also, every statue is becoming an angel. Also, we are trapped in the ship now, and they're coming in. Also, Angel Bob is talking to us. Also, there's a crack on the universe. Like, it never feels like they're running out of track to lay. It is like, it is honestly kind of amazing just how well-structured this episode is.
Also, like, it is one of those things where I hadn't remembered, like, I remembered the twist that all the angels in the maze are, you know, all the statues in the maze are actually, like, angels that had just, like, dried up over the years. And I'd forgotten, like, if it had just come out of nowhere that it's just like, oh, the Aplines have two heads. I'm like, you can't give it. But no, like, they give it, like, a good 5-10 minutes where it's just like they mention the two heads thing. And then it's just like, hold on. What? Like, that's such a good reveal. That's such a good, like, oh, okay. Like,
I almost wish they started earlier. It's such a good reveal that I almost wish they, from the start, you knew that they were two-headed. Yeah. Because it is the best kind of reveal, which is a reveal where the audience,
like, even with the 5 minutes, you still don't quite clock it. Like, you, like, you're just like, these guys had two heads. You're like you even like right. even if you kind of like paid attention, you're just like, you don't really notice until they notice. I think that's from you. I think you could have, but it would have been a harder thread to. It would have been a harder needle to thread, I think, if you had like done that from the start.
Yeah, but, you know, and also
I would like to see the version where like they pull that out for most of the episode, but as it is, it's still solid. It's still a good, like, it's still a good reveal. It's you know, it's up there.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a great reveal. When I say like it could have been a little bit earlier, is because it is the best kind of reveal that Doctor Who does, in my opinion. The best kind of reveal, which is a reveal that when you are watching it, it feels like a surprise. But when you think about it, it is like very well set up. Like, it's been there since the start. I know there is another example of, I mean, it is kind of like the Where does that door lead to from 11th Hour? It's a twist that Moffat really loves, which is like, yeah, we've been saying that we've ordered two burgers. There's two people here. So who is that third person who's been here all the time? You know, it's Moffat's favorite magic trick.
It's his favorite magic trick.
His favorite magic trick is saying that the person who did this was actually River Song. He loves that. He said, I would not be surprised if, I mean, it's the fucking Knox in Listen. Like, I would not be surprised if River Song also told the Doctor to steal that TARDIS. Like, it was Clara and then River Song and then Maverick Chen. So many people just coming in to be like, hey, you should steal that TARDIS. Chen is dead.
Stark reality. The one thing I forgot to mention, the bit that really I don't think works, and it's a bit that I think even Moffat himself doesn't work, is the Amy bit at the end, where like he's like, you know, come on, Doctor. It feels so out of place and out of nowhere, like, to drop this whole.
There are ways to handle, you know, like, I'm getting married, but also like I've had a crush on you, and it's very 2010. It's very 2010 Moffat. It's very Matt Smith era Moffat, because it smacks of the stuff in 7B that I hate with like Clara and the Doctor, of just like, it's a little too much. Like it's kind of that sneaking through.
The problem with it is that, and I'm not sure if this is the first episode we'll talk about it, because again, we are recording these out of order. This is the earliest in the chronological thing that I think we'll mention this. Matt Smith is sexless. In this role, he is sexless. He has no sex. Mm-hmm. He has no riz. The 11th Doctor has no riz.
He has no drip.
And he has no swag, as they would say in 2010. This is not a bad thing. I think if the 11th Doctor had come out today, they would have straightforward just made him asexual. Because that is kind of how Matt Smith plays him as. Every time he kisses somebody or does like a sex thing, it feels like a performance. I'm thinking about that line where he's like says that Clara is a too tight miniskirt. It feels fake. It feels like, yeah, this is how men talk about women, right, guys?
This is how it does not feel real.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is how the lads talk about women. Him kissing River Song feels very much like, yeah, like she's his beard. It's, you know, like she's not.
It's the bags of sand line from 40-Year-Old Virgin. Like that's Matt Smith's entire vibe.
Which I think, honestly, and this is where we're going to get into a little bit of like the meta aspect of Doctor Who. I think that sexlessness is part of the reason why the Matt Smith era took off the way it did and became such a big hit with the Tumblr crowd. Because I think the sexlessness,
because, and again, I need to emphasize this.
It is not a bad trait.
No.
Yeah.
It makes him safe. He's an early Tumblr soft boy is what you're trying to get at.
Yes. It makes it every doctor up until 11 had a level of sexlessness. I would even say that when Tennant is sexy, he is sexless. Like, but 11 feels like the first one where the actor came in and realized that this was like a part of the character. Ironically enough, the doctors that have the least sexy things on screen are the sexiest. 3 is very sexy. 12 is very sexy. You know, like it's like the more that the character, the more that each era tries to play up the sex and the romance, the less sexy the Doctor becomes.
Well, I mean, you know, what this also really means is that Hartnell is the sexiest Doctor.
Hardo is a sexy. Well, Hardo has a granddaughter, so clearly he has had sex. You know, so the reason I bring this up is because I feel like this is the first of him being sexless. Also, I don't really know if it was like a conscious choice on Matthes and Smith's part. I think maybe I would give Smith credit and say that at some point he thought about it.
Because anytime Matt Smith is maybe the most where he's just like, oh, I just had a night with, you know, whatever. But it's also like anytime like there is physical affection with him, he always plays it as he's very like out of his depth and like, oh no, I don't like this. Please stop. Like, don't do this to me.
Right. Like, which to me is also a harbinger. He also acts as a harbinger of the kind of male protagonist that would become so emblematic in the 2010s, which is the sexy, sexless, soft person. And I think, you know,
he is the blueprint for the Tumblr soft boy.
I would even say he is also the blueprint for Marvel. You know, Marvel has so many of these characters who are so pretty, but they have no riz. They have no sex. Like Chris Evans as Captain America is kind of this.
Ruffalo in some way. Ruffalo especially. Like Ruffalo is the one who kind of gets the most of that Weed and Moffat stuff of like, oh look, he's such a soft boy. Like that's yeah.
We're also not saying that Marvel copy from Doctor Who. I don't think Kevin Feige has ever heard the words Doctor Who in his life. It's like how people have cell phone face where you look at them, you know, this person knows what a cell phone is. People have just does not know what Doctor Who face is, which is like you have never heard the worst Doctor Who in your life.
Yeah. 100%. No, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely that. I think Feige has people around him who have seen Doctor Who.
Right.
He has not seen it himself, but I think I think the people who were in like creative for like a lot of early Marvel kind of like had that idea of like, you know, Doctor Who kind of Matt Smith. What if we like, or at least, you know, we're aware of like, what if this was the type of character that we wrote around? Cause David Tennant, end of David Tennant is really like what gets people in the Doctor Who because he's David Tennant. He's so young. He's so, you know, charismatic. He's so everything. But Matt Smith is when the show took off. Matt Smith is when it became just like, it was all over Tumblr. Like Matt Smith is the super Hulock doctor. Like that's the biggest thing.
It makes it is a trait that makes him safe, but also makes him very much, how do I put this? Approachable, you know, like you can imagine yourself having all sorts of romances with the 11th Doctor because he could. He hasn't, but the fact that he hasn't makes it just as much possible that he could. I don't think that
you can project on him like in a way that you can't with like in a way that you couldn't with Tennant, where Tennant has a very specific vibe. You're like, I know what this is. You know, I know what this would be like. You know, like Capaldi. You know, like hasn't. Smith is in that sense kind of a blank slate of like, oh, you can project anything onto him, like, you know, like, oh, you know, like he can be a bit of a bad boy, he can be a, you know, like he would go to Barnes and Noble with me, you know, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And it's also, and I think going back to the scene, it is also why that scene at the end does not work, because Amy is not in love with the Doctor. She just wants to fuck him. That is very clearly what she wants to do. She's like, I want to fuck this guy before I get married. But the problem with that is, since you took romance out of the picture, it is so much more clear how he feels so into this. Like, he's not into this at all. And it just feels like we're fretting, like we're waiting, we're doing like this very weak patter until he realizes that it's the date that the explosion happens and ushers her into the thing. Like, that's what it feels like. Because he has no riz, because he has no drip, we're just kind of waiting for the scene to be over.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Riz,
he has no riz, he has no drip. His bitch is too good. They're not going to kill him. He's fine.
Yes. He's fine. He's fine. He would not have sex. He would not. He's not Skibbity. He's not Skibbity. He's not Gat. And he's not from Ohio.
But he. You know, we've reached
the
end
of the episode where we're talking about Skibbity Talent. He would be like, gooning. He is the gooning.
He would be gooning. Like out of all the doctors, Smith is the most likely to be gooning.
Let's cut this. I don't like this. I don't like to talk about him.
Yeah.
I know. We know we've reached the end of the episode when we're talking about Skibbity Toilet.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, if we're talking about 2010, I feel like it's very important before we go. We're recording this episode on the 6th of March, and it has just been announced that Rooster Teeth is shutting down, which really feels like, you know, it. This and Rooster Teeth both feel like 2010 in a nutshell.
My memory of being on Tumblr around like 2010, 2013 era is just like Rooster Teeth, Doctor Who. That's what was showing up on my dashboard because that's what my friends were into. Kind of makes it even crazier that Russell T. Davies is back. Like that's
Yes, but Russell T. Davies feels like he belongs to an era pre-Tumblr, right? That's why I feel about him coming back.
Russell T. Davies, in some ways, created Tumblr, but was not around for what he wrote. Like he's now bookending Tumblr in some ways. Like he created Tumblr, dipped, Tumblr died, he came back.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's. Tumblr died, he came back. Rooster Teeth died. I also think that, you know, this has nothing to do with Doctor Who. We just like to talk about this. We were talking about this literally before we started recording. But I think, like, you know, nowadays you see companies like Dropout and Critical Role just kind of sweeping the floor, like taking over everything. And I mean, Rooster Teeth laid the groundwork for these companies. Rooster Teeth laid the groundwork for any digital media company that has like a following of like people on Tumblr or any of these social medias, you know? Yeah, I think the thing I'm trying to say is niche. Yeah.
Yeah, Rooster Teeth, like truly, like in some ways created the internet that we're on. Like Red versus Blue is so formative for like, you know, Machinima and like so many forms of like YouTube video that it's are still around today. Like it's kind of crazy like how like influential Rooster Teeth is. I was never a big Rooster Teeth person, but like they were so influential. They were so powerful for like 10, 15 years.
In a way, what we're saying also applies to Doctor Who in this era. They were so powerful for 10, 15 years. And then what happened? They cast a woman who pronouns. No, just kidding. What happened is life changed. Life changed. The world changed. And
TV changed.
TV changed. It's just like, I don't think episodes like this would happen nowadays. It's just not enough time.
I mean, partially it's just like, it's just time constraints, but it's also just like, yeah, because if you're only doing like 8 episodes, you're like, do we just need like a fun little adventure in the middle? No, we don't need like 2 episodes on like Weeping Angel deep lore.
Yeah, because ostensibly you could take out the Weeping Angels and put the parts that just matter to the actual like ongoing plot, right? You could do that, and it would amount to about 20 minutes of screen time. And you could see somebody going, "Can we just take these 20 minutes and put them into another episode, and then we just save 2 episodes, right? Right there." But the reason the fact that they could do it, and that the fact that they could like just write these stories about these monsters and give them this deep lore, it is almost Big Finishy in its conception and in its development. And absolutely, you know, I miss stuff like this in TV. I miss stuff like this on TV. It's like, I think to bring it back to how we started, something David said really struck me, which is, this is the great blueprint for a Doctor Who movie. And it is, right? It felt like this is, and the reason it is because it is a contained story. It is a story with a beginning, middle, and end, and you come out so satisfied. You come out with questions, but you come out like with a big smile on your face, and like, that was a good episode.
You don't need to know anything coming into this. You could show this episode to someone who has never seen Doctor before, and they would get it. They're like, okay, there's this time traveler. He's got a friend. Oh, here's this woman that he's met before, but who knows him better than he knows her. Like,
yeah,
you could show someone who's never even heard of Doctor Who this two-parter, and they would get it. Like it's so self-contained. It's so clean.
It even works if you haven't seen Blink. Right? It even works if you haven't seen Blink.
Like Blink.
In fact, we need Blink to find a person kind of who's like, seen this first.
I know some people. I could probably make this happen.
Yeah, we should. Like, we should probably show. We gotta do that. We need to show Time of Angel. No. We need to show Angels Take Manhattan to somebody, and then we show the other ones. Like, we'll see what happens there.
And that's who you have as your guest for Time of Angels. You have someone who saw that first, and then the rest, and ask them what they thought.
That's what we need. Listen, let's get our band Gesserit on and start eugenics so that we can get somebody who has only seen that episode and nothing else about the Weeping Angels. We got to do that. Let's get it going.
Austin Butler, glad to have you on the podcast.
David, you want to wrap it up?
You've
been very quiet.
I have. I don't know. I've had nothing to say. I haven't said already. Just listen. Look. Just remember. Don't forget. Just remember. Okay. Remember. Don't forget. Remember. You gotta remember. Gotta remember. Who are we talking to? There's no one else here.
Hey. I know. I'm here.
What? Who? Who? What? Who?
Hi, Nathan, one of your most regular guests.
What's that light? I'm gonna look at the light.
David, you know what? I'll go check out that light for you. You feel like you're just wrap up the episode of them. I'm gonna go check out that light, see what's up with it. All right, just
sounds good.
Yeah.
Who are we talking to?
What?
Who are we talking to?
We've been talking to anyone, don't we?
Well, it's been great doing this episode with just you on Time of Angels and no one else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a light over there. Do you think I should look at this? Do you think I should go to the light and see what's happened with that light? Or, I'm going to go check that light. Be right back.
Okay. Anyway, thank you so much for coming to my solo Doctor Who podcast. There's been no one else here this entire episode. I just want to say as you leave, make sure to tip your waitress, and we'll see you here next time for the episode that comes after this, which of course I know, and I'm not looking it up right now. It's Amy's Choice. See you next time.
It's Vampires of Venice.
It's Vampires of Venice, shit!
Next time on Pod Tour Who Cast.
Rory, we need to talk about your fiancé.
Upsetting you somewhere. Together.
Ooh, what, like a date?
Venice! Venezia!
Something happens in there. Something evil.
Pale, creepy girls you don't like so much.
Am I thinking what I think I'm thinking?
Vampires!
In Venice.
This whole thing is mental.
The people upstairs are very noisy. There aren't any people upstairs.
I knew you were going to say that. Did anyone else know you was going to say that?
Move!
You need someone on the inside.
No. Are you insane?
You don't have another option.
You have no idea how dangerous you make people to themselves when you're around.
Amy, come back!
I'll be fine.
They're vampires, for God's sake.
We hope.
So if they're not vampires...